Hey guys, welcome. Delighted to have with me for the very first time, David Wu of Unbound, an investment forum with a proven track record of economics, politics, and geopolitics. What is David Wu famous for? Well, he, like us, felt he was one of the few analysts that put down Trump to win in 2016. He put down a contested election in 2020, a very close yet contested election in 2020. And he actually, watch this, go Google it for yourself, has put forward the notion that he could see the possibility of a Trump assassination attempt or maybe a successful attempt. I don't know if that means we're done. But anyway, we'll find out in a second. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's quite a lot of geopolitical and quite out there predictions for someone who's in macro strategy. I'm sure we'll get into the financial markets and the Trump trade. In fact, let's set you up for the first question. What is the Trump trade and should people have great confidence in it?
Yeah, it's actually funny for me to talk about the Trump trades because I actually coined the term, believe it or not. In 2016, I think it was in September, you know, I was at the time the head of global rates and currencies research at Bank of America. And I said that I thought Trump was going to win. I thought there was going to be a clean sweep for the Republicans. And I thought that we were going to see expansionary fiscal policy as a result. And then from Economics 101, I said rates and basically in the dollar were going to head higher. So, you know, actually my call on higher rates and higher dollar came to be known as the Trump trades in 2016. You know, to me, it's a bit ironic that people are once again piling to these trades, in particular, the sort of, you know, the higher rates trades lately. Because again, the consensus is that, well, you know, 8 years later, Trump's going to win again, and that we're going to get, once again, a Trump basically led Republican clean sweep, and that Trump promised to basically cut taxes, and then therefore, you know, stocks are going up because stock market like basically, you know, lower taxes. And once again, bond yields are going higher, especially we're seeing steepening of the yield curve because people say, well, tax cuts means a bigger budget deficit. So I think it's actually very funny to me that for many people, I mean, you know, Trump 2.0 would just be a continuation of Trump 2.1.
So they think a rate repeat in essence.
Exactly. And yet, I think the market cannot be any more wrong.
Different, yeah.
I think in terms of understanding the similarities and basically differences. I mean, I've been doing this. I mean, I've been in the business of making predictions for 30 years, okay? And to me, if I learn anything at all, is the fact that actually the starting point matters a great deal.
Yes.
Okay. And let me tell you this, 2016 and 2024 cannot be any more different.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's take an example. Let's just take the U.S. budget deficit as an example. In 2016, U.S. budget deficit was 3.2% of GDP. Today, in 2024, the year's not over yet, but, you know, right now, the Congressional Budget Office is forecasting the budget deficit this year to reach 6.7% of GDP. Now, if you think about this, Trump 1.0 was preceded by 4 years of fiscal tightening under, basically, Obama's second term. Whereas, if Trump were to get reelected in November, okay, his second term will be preceded by massive fiscal excess under Biden. To put it in plain, you know, basically language everybody can understand the show, you know, if Obama gifted Trump a free lunch, if Biden were to lose this election, he will be leaving Trump with an empty fridge. Okay? Now, even Trump gets it. This is why, like, you know, like, think about, this is why what people need to understand, even if Trump were to win, and even if the Republicans were to achieve another clean sweep, there's going to be a massive fiscal constraint on the next, basically, government. And this is why, despite the fact Trump is talking big about tax cuts on the campaign trail, he's not really saying anything more than he's going to make his 2017 tax cuts, which are set to expire at the end of 2025, permanent. He's not saying any more than that. Now, you might say, well, what does that mean? I mean, honestly, I think 99% of Americans are not even aware of the fact that the low tax rate that they're enjoying right now, are temporary.
Yes.
So if Trump were to basically roll over these tax cuts, honestly, I don't think any American is going to feel richer as a result, or that they're going to feel that they need to go out and spend more. So from that point of view, I would say that the paper tax cuts that Trump is talking very big about, which he will deliver, I have no doubt, if he wins and clean sweep and all that, it's going to do very little to spur the economy. But it will still have to be paid for.
Correct.
The CBO right now is calculating that rolling over these tax cuts, okay, making them permanent, will add an extra $4 trillion to the U.S. budget deficit over the next 10 years. Now, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
The question is, how would Trump and the Republican Party go about paying for this? Where are they going to find this extra $4 trillion? Now, of course, Trump has hit on, you know, a beautiful idea in his mind, which is that he's going to apply a 60% tariff on imported goods from China and a 10% tariff on imports from everywhere else. Now, so the way he looks at it is like, I'm gonna make these tax cuts permanent, and I'm going to pay for it by basically levying a big tax on the rest of the world.
Which, of course, is going to have big repercussions on inflation, because all that will happen is China will increase prices or do more importing through Mexico, which is probably the reason why we've seen the Mexican peso be 3 years in a row stronger than the dollar. And in actual fact, the consumer price index will go up faster on Americans, and it's inflationary, isn't it?
Sure.
That response.
But let's even before we go there, like, you know, let's think about this for a moment, because what is the real problem here? The problem is that today, China's share of U.S. imports has fallen so much so that right now, only 13% of U.S. imports come from China.
Yeah.
This is why the 60-10% tariff scheme that Trump has in mind would only be able to raise $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years.
Okay.
To fund a $4 trillion gap. On top of that, I have absolutely no doubt, you know, a unilateral tariff on all U.S. imports would trigger the mother of trade war that is very likely to precipitate a global recession.
Yes.
Now, people say, Trump is going to be bullish for the stock market. Now, listen, let's put it this way. Global recession is deflationary. So we could talk here about, maybe tariff in equilibrium is inflationary, but the transition path could very well be deflationary. So from that point of view, honestly, I don't know. I cannot tell you with a straight face. Okay.
Yeah.
Do I think that Trump 2.0 is going to be bullish bonds or bearish bonds? What about the stock market? Right. The stock market right now is rallying, thinking, wow, Trump is going to basically, you know, bring back the the edible spirit. Think about it this way. What a lot of Americans are not aware of is the following. The European Union, okay, over the last 6 months, have been pounding the table, insisting on, a minimum 15% international corporate tax.
Yeah.
Because what they're saying is that, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, these companies are making a lot of money in Europe. But because they're headquartered in the U.S. and we're in Ireland, we have not been able to basically hit them, draw some money back. Now, so they have actually, five European countries have already imposed a digital services tax on big tech American companies like Facebook and so on and so forth. They've imposed on them, but right now they haven't started collecting these taxes. They're just accruing these taxes. You know, they're using this as a leverage in their negotiation with the U.S. And then they have decided they were going to basically give Biden a little bit of a slack. You know what? Let's wait until the election is over before they're really going to drive home this point. Because now the Europeans are getting ready. They've already got the rest of G20 ready to pounce on the Americans. Now, if Trump were to actually declare a 10% tariff on the rest of the world, in my view, this is just going to absolutely give everybody, the European included, the perfect excuse to tax Amazon, tax Microsoft, tax Apple, tax Google. You know what? In my view, this is very simple. I mean, this is going to be a catastrophe for the U.S. stock market, by the way. I don't tell you that.
Right? Yeah.
Moreover, I would say is this. Well, you say, well, what does that mean for the dollar? My view about the dollar, I have been the number one ranked currency strategist in Wall Street for 20 years, okay? And I can tell you something about the dollar, okay? Basically, in my view, the dollar's outlook depends crucially on basically the Magnificent Seven. That are the golden goose that lays basically the golden eggs for America.
And just on that point, the Swiss National Bank has almost turned into a Mag 7 hedge fund. And that is obviously international money flowing into a dollar to buy the Mag 7, which are the super dominant oligopoly class. Yeah. Okay, carry on.
When people are talking about the dollar hegemony and whatever, that's what it's about. The fact is that, you know, if you look at the first quarter, I mean, there's a reason why. If you look at, for example, in the last 20 years, from 2000 to 2010, okay, the U.S. stock market underperformed the stock market of the rest of the world. In the last 10 years, U.S. stock markets outperformed MSCI World ex-USA 9 out of the last 10 years.
Yeah.
It all thanks to tech, of course.
Yeah.
In the last basically 12 months, the combined EBIT, earnings before tax and interest, of the Magnificent Seven increased by 50%. These are already the biggest company in the world, and their earnings went up 50%. Whereas the other 493 S&P 500 companies, their earnings went down 6%.
Yeah. Yeah. And the stock market is the oligarchy, isn't it? It literally is the oligarchy.
Not oligarchy. They're monopolies.
Yeah.
They are big tech monopolies. A U.S. uses foreign policy to protect them so they can go out there and milk the rest of the world. And then because they are creating, you know, basically hugely profitable businesses, investors around the world, the only way they're actually going to actually, you know, basically generate decent returns is buy dollars and buy these companies.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. This is why if you look at actually the return on capital of the U.S. of S&P 500, it's not only the highest in the world, it's gone up a lot just in the last 6 months. By the way, you know, we sit here and talk about, why can the U.S. basically live with high interest rates? Like, why isn't the Fed cutting rates already? I mean, with high interest rate, why hasn't the U.S. already gone into a recession a long time ago?
Yeah, the Swiss and the Eurozone has. Sorry, carry on.
The return on capital in the U.S. has gone up so much that companies can actually continue to invest even with the high cost of capital.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why the Magnificent Seven, AI-generated AI, are the reasons why the U.S. has defied high interest rates and the dollar has done very, very well. Now, my point here is that very simply, and now it doesn't really matter if you're American, depending on you're American, you're not Americans, you might hate the Magnificent Seven, well, you love the Magnificent Seven, but there is no question that if Trump were to go down the path of imposing tariffs on the rest of the world, he might as well start cooking the Magnificent Seven tomorrow. And this is why I'm not even sure that he's going to be able to do it. I mean, let's put it that way. But be that as it may, what I'm just telling you is this. What I'm telling you is the following. People, and then what about Bitcoin? I mean, that's another good example, right? Like, everybody is piling to Bitcoin. Bitcoin has gone through the roof ever since, you know, the assassination of Trump.
Also framed as a Trump trade by many. Yeah. I still don't fully understand that because he's spoken this negatively. So, yes, please cover that.
The reason is because, listen, Trump clearly is trying to appeal to younger voters, right? I mean, this has been a big story about this election, which is that an unprecedented share of young people are now basically saying in polls that they're going to vote for Republicans voting for Trump because now Trump is cool. I mean, this is why Trump is basically like, wow, you know, he's like, please, you know, you're allowed. He actually takes Bitcoin for donation, okay? And I think, you know, it's part about being cool. He's now doing his own NFT and so on and so forth. But one thing is very clear to me. There is no way. Listen, I have a lot of respect for Trump. I think he's good. I've been known as the biggest Trump supporter on Wall Street. Now, let me tell you this. There is no way Trump is going to sound bullish once he's in the White House. Because any president that is going to be facing this giant fiscal black hole. He's not going to want to encourage any alternative to the U.S. dollar, whether it's the RMB or Bitcoin for that matter. So from that point of view, again, all these notions that, oh, sell bonds because of Trump because inflation is coming, or that buy stocks because Trump is going to cut taxes, or that Trump likes basically Bitcoin, let's go buy Bitcoin. Or for that, I mean, you know, there's a lot of, we're basically buying energy stocks. That's the stupidest thing, actually. Because energy stocks are actually, Trump is actually very bearish for energy stocks. Simply because Trump, for sure, I mean, you're going to see much more drilling under Trump, which means lower oil price. And oil price is not going to be good for energy stocks.
Yeah.
So all in all, what I'm saying is that, you know, I think, you know, I've done this a long time. And forget about like retail. I mean, obviously, retail investors don't anything, but that's fine. I mean, that, you know, but they, you know, because clearly there is information asymmetry between retail and Wall Street, right? I mean, Wall Street, think about this, is the big banks, you know, and then Bloomberg, and then news, and then the big basic institutional investors. They're trying to basically keep the information from retail, right? I mean, so yeah. That's fine. But so therefore, there is this mystique, well, these institutional guys really know a lot. But the honest truth is, like, you know, they don't know that much either. That's the bottom line, which is why, like, you know, we're trying to do this. I mean, this is what I'm trying to do, basically trying to share my knowledge acquired over 20 years, basically with you two. I'm probably the only person who actually brings the credibility that I do. I've got a PhD in economics from Columbia University. I started my career at International Monetary Fund. I was the number one ranked, basically, strategist for a long time in macro. I led the number one ranked, basically, macro strategy team on Wall Street for 10 years, Bank of America. So my point here is that, you know, like, you know, these sort of like trades that everybody's trying to pile in that are obvious, you got to basically stop and think, like, does that make sense? Because every prediction, behind every prediction are assumptions. What assumptions people are making? And in my view, at the moment, people are making very unrealistic expectations, very unrealistic assumptions about what Trump is going to do or not do if he's elected.
Yeah, I love that. And interestingly enough, the starting point, your excellent monologue, the starting point is totally different, is so valid. You're talking about more than double the deficit. We've got that $1 trillion every 100 days that Yellen's been adding that he's going to have to eat and manage. So it's a very different environment. Doesn't that also point to, if he's needing to keep the dollar relatively firm, the scope for rate cuts is far less than people expect. Unless, of course, he does what you were referring, causes a recession as a result of bringing in tariffs that get countermeasures and we have a global trade war and we end up getting chaos, a great sort of disinflationary effect, which may lead to a little bit more room through a demand-destroying event, essentially, an engineered demand-destroying event. But it surely doesn't have the wiggle or the Treasury stroke Fed don't have the room to overspend, the Treasury, and the Fed don't really have the room to cut as much as people think. Because he's also seen to be dovish on rates and dovish on, you know, tax, all the pro-business stuff, which is lower tax, keep rates pretty low, stimulate economic activity. Surely he's much less, more constrained there as well. Talk around that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's look at the numbers. I mean, I want to tell you a little bit about, you know, the Biden administration's black magic, okay, financial black magic. Now, as you know, like as you said, you know, the budget deficit right now is running at about $2 trillion, which means over the last 12 months, U.S. Treasury, Janet Yellen, has issued $2 trillion of Treasury securities.
Yeah.
But of these $2 trillion of Treasury securities, believe it or not, only $500 billion of those were actually bonds and notes. In other words, with a maturity of more than 1 year or more.
Right.
Either way, just so that you know, like, which means that the other 75%
is short
all Treasury bills, very short dated stuff. By the way, 75% of Treasury issuance being Treasury bills, the only other country in the world that is similar level is Turkey. Okay, no other country is that close, by the way. No other country is that close. Now, of course, we all know that this is nothing but financial engineering.
Yeah.
Okay, being conducted by basically Janet Yellen by U.S. Treasury, in order to cap long-term rates, in order to get Biden reelected.
Yes.
I mean, everything they're doing the last 18 months is engineered to keep, to basically get Biden reelected. For the same, the other thing that they were doing is that they stopped enforcing, okay, the existing sanctions on Iranian oil export. So the Iranian oil export went from 200,000 barrels per day to now 1.5 million barrels per day. Yeah. They did that. The U.S. did that deliberately to cap oil prices.
And keep inflation down, yeah.
So they're capping oil prices. They're capping basically like long-term interest rates, you know. And I've never seen, and they've done this for a long time, never seen anything like this. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. But what it means is this, right? So think about it another way. So $2 trillion, $1.5 trillion of treasury bills. Guess what? In the last 12 months, foreign investors bought $500 billion of bonds and notes, which means what U.S. Treasury, what Janet Yellen issued to Americans were only bills, okay, with a duration less than 6 months. Now, if you think about what this basically means, I mean, this is a very dangerous thing. This is why I think Trump, as I said before, Trump is going to be inheriting
a huge mess. I was just about to say, this sounds like a poison pill cliff because it makes Biden look good now, but it's storing up immediate roll debt that needs rolling again.
Because that those $1.5 trillion of bills will mature next year at some point, and there will have to be a rollover. And then at the same time, they'll still have to basically finance $2 trillion deficit. So you're talking about gross issuance of $3.5 trillion, maybe even $4 trillion. Who the hell have that kind of money? You know, and I think you know, nobody in their sane mind will even want to be Treasury Secretary next year.
No. But who's going to buy it? The point is, who buys it? Yeah, okay. Who buys it? Surely the Fed ends up being the toxic bank. So we've gone from having toxic commercial banks to eventually having a forced situation where the Fed has to be the buyer of the last resort for the Treasury spending like a drunken sailor. How does it end?
You see, this is why it's interesting, right? Because, again, this year, let's just say, like, even though they're not issuing bonds and that kind of thing, you know, we said, because of the Magnificent Seven, right? You know, the U.S. stock market has been able to live with high interest rates. And high interest rates basically make the dollar more attractive. So the dollar has been strong in 2024 and 2023, despite, you know, the deficit situation. Now, imagine a situation, because I'm very much of the view that we're looking at basically an AI bubble.
Okay. Yeah.
AI may turn out to be a wonder, maybe 3-5 years down the road. I think there is no way in hell, because right now the consensus on Wall Street is this. If you look at earnings per share estimates for this year, is for a 10% growth. For next year, it's 13% growth. What the market is baking into these numbers is the expectation that the earnings growth that we're currently seeing basically from the Magnificent Seven will start to basically spill over into the other 493 companies that somehow generative AI is going to basically start lifting all boats. I mean, this is a longer story and we can go into this.
How does that get reconciled? I've got to jump in there, David. How does that get reconciled with a wrecked consumer? Because whether you have AI or not, at some point, surely, you've got to look at your retail consumer market that is really suffering right now. All the stats are pointing to that. Sort of H1 was, quarter one was everything is awesome. We're doing okay. Europe is weak. Quarter two is like, oops, the data don't look so great. And that's why we had the recent dip in the dollar. It was unemployment coming in higher and it was CPI lower on expectations. When does the man in the street actually become part of this? Or are there two economies? It's like the twisted balloon that the clown does for the kids. We've got one super economy that's the AI Magnificent Seven, and we've got a deflating other half, sausage, that's been pinpricked. How do you square that circle?
So let's square the circle this way, right? We know, like, you know, right now, you know, 25% of the total profits generated by S&P 500 is coming from these seven companies, right? And I told you the other 493 companies are suffering, right? And yet, at the same time, these seven companies barely hire altogether a million people.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, they basically hire, they employ a fraction of the American labor force. Okay.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, the fact that they're doing well doesn't mean that they're hiring more people, or at least not in a way that actually moves the needle. So from that point of view, literally the only way for the circle, you know, to come together is somehow this, you know, basically that the generative AI is going to somehow be widely adopted. The U.S. companies in general are going to partake in this, basically, you know, this technological revolution that will raise their productivity, and they're going to grow faster, and then they're going to hire more people as a result. Well, that's what I'm telling you. That is the implicit assumption.
Yeah.
That the economy, that the S&P EPS is going to grow 13% next year, and that somehow the U.S. economy is going to avoid a recession. That has to happen. But in my view, that's very unlikely to happen. And let me tell you why that is almost definitely not going to happen. Right. Think about it this way. Right. What is really going on so far with this generative AI? Just a little bit like, you know, Trump's promised tax cut. Right. I mean, it is really, it's just a paper tax cut. It's like, you know what? I gave you a Christmas present 8 years ago. I'm going to take it back and give it to you again for this year's Christmas, right? That's what it is, right? That's Trump's tax cut, right?
Right.
Now, the Magnificent Seven is even more insane, right? Because what really is going on, right? So NVIDIA is selling chips, right, to the other Magnificent Seven. Because, you know, in fact, more than half of the chips that NVIDIA is selling to these other Magnificent
Seven. Yeah, the six. Yeah, yeah.
The other six, right? Now, why? Because four out of these six basically are among the five biggest cloud service providers.
Cloud and server, yes, yeah.
So so that is basically Amazon, that's Microsoft, that's basically Google and Meta. So these four companies are buying these chips from NVIDIA, paying a lot of money for these chips, in order to offer AI-enabled cloud services to their clients, okay? And they picked up, you know, their revenue has gone up a bit. Not that much, but it's gone up a bit. However, so you say, well, then based on what, so why are they reporting like record profit, earnings growth, going crazy? Well, guess what? The money that they're spending on these very expensive chips, the hundreds of billions of dollars, don't hit their income statement right away. They only hit their income statement through graduated depreciation.
Yeah.
So as a result, it looks like they've seen a massive improvement in their profit margin. But a lot, this paper profit is still contingent on their basically, you know, essentially making that future investment worthwhile.
Yeah.
So what I'm telling you, this is the most important point, which is that even, I mean, you're talking about massive earnings growth, and yet the honest truth is it's literally paper profit. It's only profit because the actual cost is not being basically
reflected. So it's a big lump of sunken capital for which you're only acknowledging it can be written off maybe 10, 5 years, and you're only acknowledging a 10% of your
time. Exactly. Okay. That's why whether this is going to be good investment, we have yet to see. We will know for 5 years. Now, just think about everybody else. Now, for everybody else, okay, who are not going to be buying these chips, because these chips are very expensive, who are going to be paying Microsoft or Google a subscription fee for accessing, let's just say, you know, basically AI through their cloud services.
Yeah.
Now, whatever they're going to pay them, it's going to hit their income statement today. In other words, for these companies, unless AI immediately starts to raise their productivity, it's actually going to be a drag on their earnings and their profit margin.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, this is why I think it's very important for people to understand this, because there's a lot of voodoo out there. People don't understand accounting. They don't understand anything. They just thought, well, you know what? This is, you know, 50% earnings growth, Magnificent Seven. But that's the reality. So what I'm telling you is that the point here is this. For the U.S., for Trump, the problem right now is if next year, if just any time, because what I'm telling you is that they're going to have, Trump is going to have to roll over, is going to basically find $3.5 trillion next year, even without any tax cut, nothing. Just based on the current trajectory, $3.5 trillion. He's going to struggle to find $3.5 trillion. And then if the whole AI bubble were to burst meanwhile, the U.S. stock market goes down, which means the dollar is going to collapse and the rate's going to go down. I mean, God, we're going to have a major economic crisis in 2024. And so from that point of view, I think that to me is the real Trump trades. What we need to recognize is that Trump is inheriting
a poison channel
economy that's propped up by financial engineering by the Biden people.
Yeah.
On top of that, just think about something else, which is equally challenging. Right. In the last 4 years, okay, the immigration agencies in the U.S. have recorded 8 million encounters with illegals at the U.S.-Mexican border. That means at least 8 million people made their way into the U.S. illegally.
And something 20 plus are in. Exactly. I mean,
and then not to mention the fact that there are all these people that they did not encounter, therefore they were not recorded. Yeah. So let's call it, I don't know, 12 million, 15 million, who knows what the number is. Now, if you look at Trump's, you know, basically campaign agenda, right? Number one is not tax cut. Number one is not ending the Ukraine war. Number one is border security. Number two is to carry out the biggest deportation of illegals in American history. Now, I'm sure Trump is feeling good about this because, and then, you know, as you know, I mean, Trump is a man of his word. And the reason why this is so high on his agenda is because it happens to be the case if you look at polls. 55% of Americans say that they support mass deportation, including 45% of Democrats. So if Trump were to win this election, you know what? It's going to have a lot to do with his promise to deport. So he'll have to do it. Now, listen, let me tell you this. You know, he should basically go check it out in southern Italy or southern Spain or in Greece, for that matter, try to deport people.
Not easy.
I mean, forget about 10 million people. Even deporting a million people will be a very messy business.
Now, and very bad PR.
Who's probably going to be the next, whatever, Secretary of Homeland Security, is talking about sending in the military to round up the illegals, put them in camps, and then deport them. You think it's going to be that easy? For one thing, you're going to have to find a country that's willing to take them. Okay? What? I mean, how much are you willing to basically pay for some country to basically take them off your hand? I mean, just imagine the military goes into sanctuary cities and then to round up people and having to face off with violent Antifa people.
Terrible media as well. It's going to be terrible media coverage. It's going to be, you know, mums and babies and...
My heart goes out to Donald Trump because I love that guy. I think he is great. He's got all the great ideas. But he's going to be, as I said before, he was gifted by Obama with a free lunch. And then not only he's staring into an empty fridge, it's a fridge that's full of fucking worms and basically bullshit. And this is, and then people are going to blame Trump. But in the end, I just want to say this to your viewers, especially those who support Trump, that it's not going to be his fault. And by the way, I don't even know if he's going to be president, but that's a different story. We can talk about that.
Well, so. I wanted, on that point, while you just captain, he's going to be on president. So you predicted, I'm assuming, an assassination attempt, not a successful assassination. Is your prediction that that was it and he then goes into a landslide, or will there be further attempts that may or may not be successful? Where do you stand on that? It's a little bit off the macro.
People can Google me. Like 6 months ago, in various interviews, I said that I thought Trump was going to get assassinated in 2024.
So you actually think he'll be terminated, like as in dead?
No. I think, you know, I don't know. Like I just said that there would be assassination attempt. I said that I wasn't sure if he's going to survive it, but that's it. But what I'm telling you today is this. Now that, you know, so I've been getting congratulatory emails from everybody this past weekend after, you know, basically... You know, and so people say, what do you think now? Well, let me put it this way to you. I think what has been sort of like, again, I'm not thinking about this. Like, it's not because, like, this is not about, like, whether I'm mega or anti-mega. That's nothing to do. We're just talking about making predictions. That's what I do for a living. I make a lot of money making predictions. And then my clients only care if I'm right or not. Okay? Now, In my view, the question we have to ask ourselves is, okay, so there was an assassination attempt. Will there be another one? Okay. Now, I think in order to answer that question, I think first of all, we have to ask ourselves, well, was the first attempt the work of a crazy lone wolf? Or there was something more to it? Look at the evidence carefully. Again, I don't know the answer to that question. All I know is that, okay, that the evidence is indecisive in terms of whether it was a lone wolf or maybe there were more people involved. Because if you look at just the evidence that we've got right now, you know, obviously we all know Trump was hit in New York, which means whoever was trying to kill him was literally like aiming for his head. In other words, it was definitely shoot to kill. Now, and we also know that something, which is that literally he hit his ear. That means he only missed.
Do we know that?
Millimeter, right? Exactly.
Do we really know?
David,
that's the thing.
150 yards away, I would say the shooter is a very good shooter. Now, on top of that, we know that the shooter, for sure, did not have any military training. So he had nothing to do with the military. He didn't even own his own gun. He had to basically borrow his father's gun. So how did he manage to become such a good shoot? And then what? And this kid, besides shooting, he had to basically prepare everything in order to get on the roof to make sure he's not seen. I mean, listen, I mean, like, you know, I live in Israel. I'm here right now in Israel. Like, I've been joking about this with some friends, which is, well, you know, listen, this kid, like, I mean, if you had told me this was like Mossad, I can understand. Just some 20-year-old kid, like, you know, it's impossible. I mean, basically, this is a professional job. Now, on top of that, it's almost too convenient that he's a registered Republican. You know, can you imagine he had been a registered Democrat? That would have made a lot of noise. How convenient it happened on a Saturday. Because if it hadn't happened on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, the stock market would have gone down 10%. It had to happen, of course, on a Saturday. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, I'm just assuming right now there's only a 50% chance that this was basically a crazed lone wolf, just happens to be very, very good at what he did as an assassin, okay? Which means there's a 50% chance, you know, there is something more to it. The question then, therefore, is if there's something more to it, the people who were trying to kill Trump the first time around, would it try again? In my view, the answer is definitely, the probability is definitely greater than zero. Because in fact, they almost succeeded. So why wouldn't they try again? Okay. And by the way, you know, it's very clear that Trump himself thinks that they're going to try again. This is the reason why he chose J.D. Vance. Just think about this. J.D. Vance is a mini Trump. J.D. Vance adds nothing to the ticket to the extent that he's not going, I mean, he's a senator from a state where Trump is going to win by double digit anyway. He basically, another white male, he's not going to basically help bring on independents, women, blacks, Hispanics, nothing. He adds nothing to the ticket, zero in fact. The only reason why Trump is a very smart guy, okay? For Trump to basically choose him, it could only be one reason, which is Trump's trying to send a message to whoever is trying to kill him. Guess what? If you kill me, you're just going to end up with another Trump. Okay?
It's an interesting take.
I think Trump is trying to discourage people from coming after him. But be that as it may, but again, you know, again, this is the situation we're looking at. So this is why, to me, it's not obvious. And I can see a lot of people want to take him out. And I'm not even talking about basically progressives. Well, again, you know, like when you're playing detective, like in what I do for a living, I'm constantly looking for motive, right? You know, people have to have motives, you know, to do something. There are plenty of people with motives. Just think about this. U.S. is now spending $1 trillion on defense. Okay. The single biggest item, okay, for basically discretionary spending. There is a lot of money flowing there. You know, in 2020, September 2020, 2 months before the election, Trump came out publicly attacking his generals, accusing them of trying to prolong America's foreign wars so that their buddies at defense contractors can sell more planes, more tanks, more bombs to get more people killed. You know, that caused a total uproar in the defense establishment. I mean, do you think the defense establishment, including the defense industry, whatever, do you think they really want to see Trump return as commander-in-chief? You know, given how much these guys have put into Ukraine to start World War III, do you really think they want to see Trump come in and end the war in Ukraine in one day? I mean, come on. Okay? You have to be very naive to think that. Okay? So from that point of view, what I'm saying, I follow the Ukraine war very closely. I mean, you should hear the reaction in Ukraine about basically the assassination attempt. I mean, the Ukrainians are furious. Cool. Like, how can that guy miss? We wouldn't have missed. And now all of a sudden, the Biden administration is floating out. They have intelligence suggesting the Iranians are plotting, you know, basically to get Trump. Like, why didn't you say that before the assassination attack? What I'm saying is, this is why, to me, this election is not a done deal. I mean, it will break my heart. It will be the end if Trump, anything happens to Trump. But at this point, to pile into Trump trays, to me, is premature. And also, I also do think, you know, Trump does have a problem, which is, I think Biden will quit the race eventually. I think just a question of days. And I still think that the most likely outcome is that there will be a mini primary. Okay. You know, because there's no way that the Democratic cabal can just impose a candidate, okay, on basically 4,000 delegates who've been nominated, voted to basically to vote for the nominee, you know, at the convention. I think they'll have to do basically a little mini primary. My view remains that the only person who can potentially beat Trump is Gretchen Whitmer, okay, the two-time, you know, governor from Michigan. And if she somehow becomes the party nominee, I think she will definitely give Trump basically a run for his money, simply because she's a woman, she's from Michigan, she's popular in the state. She also is pro-business, by the way, and she's also very popular with progressives. I mean, there could be an issue there, okay, for Trump.
That's the brand.
I'm just giving you 20 different reasons why, you know, there are so many uncertainties. For someone, you know, like, I mean, you know, in 2016, at this point, I was pounding the table, say, put on Trump trade, Trump's going to win, clean sweep, and this thing. You know, like, that was easy. That was so easy. If I look out now, there are so many question marks, so many uncertainties, so many things can go wrong. And this is why I think, you know, people need to think twice, and I don't want people to lose money.
I want to come in and pose a different scenario. Trump is very pro-Israel. You're in Israel right now, which is an interesting, you'll have a take on the ground and the feel there. I mean, essentially Jerusalem, that used to be an international city that had the three faiths in there, has now essentially been handed over, the Golan Heights. He was hailed. They did a coin after him and referred to him as Cyrus, referring biblically to, you know, handing back the land type story. He's super pro and deemed there's an APAC stroke ADL element to him. And Vance, vice president, is very similar. You know, there's images of them both at the Wailing Wall paying their homage. Wouldn't you see if, for the people that think that there's a disproportionate influence to the Jewish community, wouldn't you see that actually is quite desired? And maybe this whole event was manufactured theater to really engage the base to ensure he gets in on a landslide. What do you think of that?
That's the biggest bullshit. Listen, I'm not even Jewish. Okay, I'm not Jewish. I live in Israel. I've been coming to Israel for 35 years. My wife is, you know, Israeli, but, you know, like, I'm Buddhist. Okay. You know, this whole idea, like, I know a lot of anti-Americans who say, oh, wow, you know, the Jews, that kind of thing, they pulled the whatever the strings. Let's be honest here. Okay. You know, Trump, in 2016, he probably got less than 15% of Jewish votes. Okay. In 2020, he had less than 30% of Jewish votes. the Jews predominantly vote Democrats. Biden, and I can tell you, like, I just met a rabbi from Florida just last week, and he's pro-Trump, and he's basically, and he was telling me, David, you cannot believe this. Like, he says that literally, like, his synagogue is now looking to fire him because they think a good Jew has no business being a Trump supporter. Okay. This is what you need. This is what people don't realize, which is that the Jewish community, okay, have been the biggest donor to the Democrats. And Obama is the enemy of Israel, and Biden is even a bigger enemy to Israel. So from that point of view, like, you know, American Jews have nothing to do with Israel. They're pro two-state solution, which is not a workable solution. And they have been enemies of Israel. They have been undermining Israel. If you look at Blinken, who's an enemy of Israel, he's Jewish. Okay? Victoria Nuland, Jewish. All these basically anti-basically Israel Jews in America, they happen to be all sitting in the Biden administration or the Obama administration.
Okay.
Trump actually, I just want to tell you this. Actually, Trump's history is actually very interesting. I mean, Trump is actually, I've always said, you know, this is why I love Trump. Trump is not a racist. That's exactly the opposite of racist. When Trump, as everybody knows about Mar-a-Lago, but not many people know about what Trump did to turn Mar-a-Lago into a private club. At the time when he decided to turn Mar-a-Lago into a golf club, okay, in Palm Beach, there were lots of clubs, but only one would accept Jews. All the other clubs, there were no Jews because they were not accepted. Trump says, my club, everybody will be allowed to come in, with Jews, Black, whatever, Chinese, whatever. He spent an extra 3 years to basically lobby and get elections, get basically some Jews onto the city council in order that he got permission to open Mar-a-Lago to take in Jewish members. That's why Trump is an amazing guy. And yet, most Jews in America hate Trump. Okay? Now, let me tell you this. What Trump did, it's not just for Jews for the Middle East. This is the most important thing. This is what people don't realize about Trump. Okay. This is why on YouTube, too many people don't get it. They're idiots. Okay. I'll give you an example. So usually when American president takes office, usually his first foreign visit will be something like the UK. Or Canada, for that matter, right? Close U.S. ally, that's where they go. Do you know which was the very first country that Trump visited on his very first foreign trip?
I would guess Israel.
No. The first country he went to was Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And Trump went to Saudi Arabia. Okay. It was very interesting because what happened was that, as you probably know, that the Saudi family, Saudi Arabia, was on very bad terms with Obama. Obama loved Iran, right? This is why the Sunnis, they hated basically Obama.
Can I jump in to sow this in? Will Trump initiate a further war and an escalation against Iran? Because he's seen as the non-war guy. There was supposedly no wars on his watch. But there's a view how...
All you know is this, Francis. All you need to know is this. Iran is not afraid of anybody, except for a man called Donald J. Trump. Because Trump basically was the guy who ordered the assassination of Soleimani. Trump imposed the most aggressive sanctions on Iranian oil export. Now, this is also the reason why I have absolutely no doubt. Okay, the Iranians are watching the U.S. elections closely. Now that they see Trump is basically leading by a big margin, what do you think Iran is going to do? In my view, Iran now has a very, very strong incentive to basically cross the nuclear Rubicon. We now know from IAEA and others that Iran is now only 1 month away. If they decide to go for nuclear immunity, it will take them 1 month to build 5 nuclear weapons. Okay. In my view, this is the biggest geopolitical risk of 2024. which is the possibility that Iran tries to get ahead of a Trump 2.0 by going for nuclear immunity so that they will be safe. And that Israel decides that we cannot allow this to happen because this will be existential, and then they go and basically bomb Iran. That scenario, by the way, has a much higher probability than people think. Listen, I'm conducting daily surveys in many countries, okay? Russia, Ukraine, everywhere, I mean, including Iran. I can tell you at the moment, okay, 50% of my Iranian respondents think that Iran should have a bomb. Okay, this is up from just basically 10% 2.5 years ago. And the Iranians believe that Biden is so weak that they might actually get away with it. Okay? And that's why every election has consequences. In this case, the anticipation of a potential Trump comeback could potentially cause Iran to go for it. And that's what this is about. That's why Israel is now trying to end the Gaza war. That's why Israel does not want to get dragged into a war with Lebanon. Because Israel knows that Iran wants Israel to get bogged down in Lebanon so that Iran makes a run for nuclear immunity. Again, in 1 month, Iran can now make 5 nuclear weapons. There is no way, and I certainly hope, that Israel is not going to allow this.
Yeah, I think that's a tinderbox, and it seems like you say that could turn into a theme of great contention going forward. Let's get back into the macro economics. So, playing our scenarios, Trump's coming in, and this will be our final question before I give you opportunity to direct our viewers to your content. If we're getting the reality of the Trump trade market actually seems disinflationary because of what he's inherited. You said, you know, you can't put it all on him. He had Obama that was doing some tightening and tidying up. He got a cleaner, you know, he got some food in the fridge. Now he's getting rotting food in a broken fridge. What would be your definition of the Trump trade? So for someone watching this says, I love the geopolitics, but it's all great gossip. None of us really know. But what do I do investing and trading wise for the next 4 years? What is the Trump trade, assuming he wins? Give us your 3 or 4 bullet plan.
It's easy. Listen, I run, you know, as I said, I run an institutional advisory business. I advise some of the biggest investors in the world. I can tell you, and I put on my own recommendations. So these are my portfolios, you know, like, you know, I think most people, I mean, it's a very expensive service. So most of your retail guys won't, you know, can afford it. But I can share with you the following. I'm currently long gold. I'm long the September VIX futures. And I'm short euro yen. Okay. So basically, and I'm also long.
Short. I misheard. Do you mean short euro yen or long euro yen?
I'm short euro yen. So I'm short euro and long yen. That's what I mean.
Okay. Okay. So you're expecting a yen rebound at the expense of the euro?
Yes, exactly. And then I'm also long 2-year notes, and I'm sure US, you know, junk bonds, high yield. So basically, I'm playing for a widening of credit spreads. So if you look at these 4 trades together, what do they basically tell you? Like, I mean, obviously they don't have 100% correlation, but they're pretty highly correlated. To the extent they all position for basically
increased volatility,
trouble,
yeah,
trouble, volatility, risk premium, and so on and so forth.
I want to drill down on the debt, the widening of the credit spreads. I was short junk, the ETF, and also I'm trying to remember the 3-letter acronym. We had a great technical HYG, high yield, HYG and junk. That's right. Going into what was the 2020 events, March 2020 events, I'll try not to say them, but you know what I'm referring to. We had great technical setup. It began to spill, and then we went into the high drama phase, which was also correlated to the medical interventions. And then the Fed just came out and basically stood behind it, said words to the effect of. And we know we've got a debt issue. We know there's a massive shelf just above investment grade that if it got downgraded, all sorts of pensions would have to divest. There's a real debt problem and debt gradients valuation. What stops them from doing the same on your yield expansion? Because we have manipulations now.
For instance, I don't, like, you know, I think long-term, but I trade short-term. So, like, literally, like, I'm in and out. I'm going to tell you something completely different by next week. I'm, you know, most of my clients are looking, some of my clients are really just big hedge funds who are moving a lot of money in the high frequency. That's not it. I mean, listen, the point here is this. This is why what you should have done back then, which is what I'm doing right now, I'm actually long 2-year notes against it, against HYG, right? Because HYG, you're just basically long high yield, right? You're short high yield. Yeah, I'm long 2-year notes against it. So basically what I'm doing is that if they were to start cutting rates aggressively, for example, and then high yield doesn't rally as much, credit spread's going to widen, I'm going to make money. So it's a relative value trade. So from that point of view, if there's going to be aggressive monetary easing, if all of a sudden the stock market falls 20%, okay, and the Fed starts to cut rates aggressively, I'm still going to make money in this trade because credit spreads are not going to go down. It's probably going to go up. In other words, basically yields on high yield will not go down as much as 2-year yields will. And that's the way you play. That's why, but you are exactly right. I think this is why, like a lot of people sitting at home, you have to be very careful what you're doing because, you know, this is why not everybody, you know, is, I mean, I've done this for 20 years. And so from that point of view, like I'm not advising people to do this at home. But I do think that, you know, but in general, I think gold, I think, will do very well. I think the way you got to think about this is this. J.D. Vance. Yeah, the difference between J.D. Vance and Trump is that Trump does not hate China. Trump actually, his granddaughter speaks fluent Chinese, by the way. I mean, Trump doesn't hate anybody. Trump is not a racist. Okay, but Trump, you know, basically wanted China to play fair. I mean, and that's what the phase one agreement was about. But if Trump were to come in, we're probably going to see a resumption of more transactional approach in terms of dealing with China. They're probably going to go back to the phase one agreement as the starting point for further negotiation. But J.D. Vance hates China. So from that point of view, if I'm the Chinese sitting in Beijing right now, I'm definitely going to be selling my dollars even more quickly to get back to get into gold. So I would say J.D. Vance as a choice is very bullish gold. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the beauty of the yen is that the yen is very, very undervalued. So from that point of view, and at the same time, you know, political risk is going up in the U.S., political risk obviously is going up in Europe. Japan, ironically, might just turn out to be a haven for political risk. And then I actually think if there's going to be any global crisis, interest rates coming down, the yen will do very, very well. So it's a very crowded trade. So I think being long yen and being long gold sort of makes sense. And also VIX is very low. Again, I'm not telling you to go buy VIX today.
Yeah,
I'm buying the September, basically VIX futures, which expires just before the election. So I'm playing for uncertainty and political risk just in the final 4 weeks in the run-up to the election.
And the VIX and the credit spread trade highlight that. And the gold trade, one can argue, highlight that. And you're also seeing a reversal in the yen because it's become too crowded on your take. That's interesting, David. That's been a fascinating discussion. I look forward to doing it again. Really interesting views. How do people, we are retail guys. There are a few hedge funds that watch our YouTube channel, but I would say broadly we retail. But for people that wanted to have engage with you further, jump on your newsletter, where do they find you and what do they need to do?
I retired from Wall Street 3 years ago with one basically mission. My mission is to share, because my wife, for 20 years, she used to introduce me as someone who makes a living making rich people even richer. So I decided after I retire, I'm going to share my experience, acquire over 20 years with everybody, on YouTube. That's why, I didn't even have a YouTube account 3 years ago. Now I've got a YouTube channel, and I have only one purpose in mind, The biggest problem in the world today is that there are too many opinions. There are more opinions than there are facts. My channel is only about facts. It's about fact-based analysis. You can call it debate. And people are welcome to come and basically disagree with me, but disagree with me with facts and not with your opinions, because opinions are not even worth the paper they're written on, most of the time. So from that point of view, again, on YouTube, people have a tendency to subscribe to channels that agree with them. Republicans listen to Republican channel, Democrats listen to Democrat channels, anti-Americans listen to your channel probably. But what I'm trying to basically say is that People need to grow up. And in my channels, you're not going to agree with everything I say, but it's fact-based. And that's why I invite you to come and check it out. David Wu Unbound.
Yeah, excellent. It's so free. David Wu Unbound. We'll put that in the show notes. Just for clarity, we're not anti-American. We love Americans and we're talking from America. But we do question a bunch. David, it's been really good. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time today. We'll put those details below so that people can click through. And I look forward to a future discussion at some point, closer maybe to the eventual outcome. It might be an interesting election evening chat.
Absolutely. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Bye-bye. 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 Bye-bye.